Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. This episode is brought to you by Joss Whedon. Love it, lest you be the outcast in your community of outcasts. And now, here are Alex and James.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. We have the return of the lone woman to ever be on the MacGuffin Men podcast. We've got Emily in the studio, our senior women's issues correspondent. Welcome again to the podcast, Emily.
Sup. I'm really happy to be your Kristen Schaal.
We're going to be talking about women in film today. It's sort of a general podcast, but we're sort of going with, you know, what we know. We're sort of starting around the year 2000. Growing up, watching movies, did you have any like general perceptions of how women were treated in film? Did you have, like, was there anything that ever stuck out to you as, I like this female character, you know, or anybody that was like, this is the worst, you know?
Well, growing up, my mom spent a lot of time telling me, you know, that the way I saw women portrayed in the media probably wasn't great. So I think I was fairly savvy. But I can't think of anyone specifically that, you know, stood out for me as being really great or really awful. As a kid, I honestly didn't watch too many movies. I hope that's okay that I'm on this podcast.
This one's pop culture then. This one's just pop culture. So yeah, around 2000, which is kind of where we're going to start this off, there was sort of this boom in, well, the 90s was kind of like getting more and more towards blockbuster culture. And in November 2000, Charlie's Angels came out and was a hit. It was the highest grossing, like opening weekend was the biggest opening weekend for a film starring female protagonists. And then it was like 40 million, which in 2000 was a pretty huge opening weekend. July of the next year, 2001, Tomb Raider opened to break that record. And was a pretty large hit as well, starring Angelina Jolie. And then a month later, Legally Blonde was a sleeper hit, opening to just over $20 million, which is way more than anybody expected, starring Reese Witherspoon. And just sort of started this, I remember reading about, well, first the box office records that women were breaking every few months, it seemed like, for a bit. And then just what those movies meant to Hollywood, like, the women can compete with the men. We've got a woman starring in a summer comedy. We've got women kicking ass. Like, females are back in the movies. And I guess my question is, do you remember those movies? Did you see any of them?
I definitely saw Legally Blonde, and I remember loving it as a kid. I thought that, you know, whether or not this was delusional, I saw the Reese Witherspoon character as being kind of a strong female, but also, you know, even though she was silly and kind of stupid and used her sexuality a lot, I did kind of feel like, oh, she went to law school and that's good. Right, Mom? Right? I can watch this movie. Charlie's Angels, I'm pretty sure I probably played Charlie's Angels as a kid, maybe with some friends or something, or I don't really remember the movie very well, and I definitely didn't see Tomb Raider. But just with this whole 2000s kind of women in film being a thing, it kind of reminded me a little bit of, you know, I know this is like early 90s, but the whole Spice Girls girl power thing, like it kind of feels a little bit like women are great, so let's put them in these movies, and it's just the fact that they're there is good.
Okay, yeah, that's fair. And I guess the Spice Girls were sort of like the female version of a boy band. And are there any other like huge versions of that, like, that were female?
Not to the same extent as the Spice Girls. I just remember the whole, you know, Spice Girls being all about girl power, but that kind of being a bit of a facade in a way.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, took us, what, like 3 minutes to start talking about pop music? yeah, and I mean, I never saw the first Tomb Raider. Oddly, I saw the second. I don't remember why, but, you know, none of those movies were particularly good. I did like Legally Blonde. I remember enjoying that. And Charlie's Angels, I definitely saw a couple times. But yeah, just, I don't know. It was just sort of, well, I guess Legally Blonde is very much a female character, you know, she's dealing with a lot of female stereotypes, throughout the movie. But, yeah, I don't know, like, I think the action movie side, it was just sort of, this movie could have been any action movie starring, like, three guys. Just some things would have had to be changed, you know, like, they wouldn't do the split so often. But, And yeah, all three of those movies had sequels within a couple of years, and all three of those sequels failed. Like, none of these movies made it to trilogy. So, yeah, I guess it was sort of a short-lived Women Are Back. And then, 2004, a delightful little film came out, Mean Girls.
Mean Girls is the best movie of all time. I'm only a little bit joking.
I would certainly... I agree that it is a great film. So what are your, like, what about Mean Girls do you really enjoy? I recognize that it is one of the greatest films of all time, but specifically.
Specifically, okay. Yeah. I think Mean Girls is legitimately funny and a well-written kind of tight story. Not tight, but as far as teen movies go. The characters are well-developed, and just the fact that you have all of those things happening and... pretty much all of the characters are female, I think, is a great thing. And people still love Mean Girls. And it's... how old?
8 years now. Like, it'll be 8 years in April. Yeah.
So. The Tumblrs are all about Mean Girls still. Yeah.
Well, everybody likes Mean Girls because it's a very good movie. Like, yeah. it's a really funny movie, but it's also good. It's like, I mean... Ferris Bueller is a bigger example, but it was like a teen movie that was also just really good and really entertaining. And, you know, it doesn't matter. Mean Girls, I mean, it's the DVD cover is pink. You know, all the posters were pink. They were very much advertising towards females. But once some guys saw it and were like, hey, this movie is actually hilarious. You know, the word spread and people saw it 1,000 times in theaters and then again on DVD. But yeah, it was written by Tina Fey, who before Mean Girls, or I think at the time of Mean Girls release, was SNL's head writer. What are your general thoughts on Tina Fey as a person, as an actress? We both like 30 Rock a lot, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I love... Tina Fey has made so many things that I love. 30 Rock is one of my favorite TV shows. Mean Girls is one of my favorite movies. Her... maybe views personally we sometimes don't agree on, mm-hmm. but I really can't say anything bad about her as a writer. And her acting took me a little while to get used to on 30 Rock, but I think once you start to understand the character of Liz Lemon, it's pretty great. Okay.
And what is your understanding of the character of Liz Lemon then?
Well, I think at first Liz Lemon might have been a little bit more of kind of a, you didn't know her very well. So it was kind of, she kind of seemed like a little bit maybe two dimensional.
Yeah. Well, I think those two dimensions were Star Wars and food in the first season. Like those are pretty much where we get, but yeah, no. And as things continued, how do you feel?
Now, I mean, after watching, have you seen the first episode? I won't spoiler, but I think that we could be getting into some really serious, different Liz Lemon territory here. And she definitely, you know, there have been some plot lines with Liz Lemon that have almost been, you know, sad or really
thought-provoking.
Yeah. And she's definitely become more of a full-rounded character than a kind of a joke.
Yeah, I agree. She is very much a... jokey character. And like, I mean, you can see, and if you go back and watch 30 Rock, she was always, towards the beginning, she was much more grounded as a person. She was, less zany, and now she's just crazy. And, they play that up, and you know, this is sort of built over the years of the show. I think, what are they on, season six now?
Yes.
Yeah. And, it's just sort of built up over time, but yeah, there are still those moments where you're like, oh, she's a person. And like, yeah, the thing I think 30 Rock does best is sort of like the friendship between Jack and Lemon. I think that's always done really well. It never really makes me kind of upset like some of Liz's romantic stuff does. But
yeah, and as much as, you know, sometimes the Liz Lemon character might get into some of the feminist views of Tina Fey that I disagree with, the episode with the comedian that has to change her identity and the way that they handle the fact that she was acting in that kind of infantile, underage, stereotypical female way because she needed to hide herself from an abusive partner was, I thought, genius. And really, there was a lot of depth to, you know, the layers of different ideas in feminism in that episode.
Yeah.
So I have to give her some credit there.
No, I like that episode a lot too. And, I mean, it's not like Tina Fey is the sole writer of 30 Rock. So credit to all the other writers of 30 Rock. But yeah, she's clearly the head creative person on the show and does write some episodes. You know, I mean, there's a writer's room for every comedy show, but written by type of thing, you know? Also in 2000... Were you done with Mean Girls? Did you have like a monologue that you wanted to do
for
like 40 minutes?
I better not, yeah. You know?
Well, like, who's your favorite character in Mean Girls, I guess? If you had to pick one.
My favorite character in Mean Girls is, now I forget her name. You know, the goth one.
Janice Ian.
Yes, Janice Ian.
That is the correct answer. Second, I am upset that you did not know her name.
I'm under a lot of podcast pressure right now to recall facts.
Yeah, okay, I apologize. I just thought that was sort of, you know.
I know, I should have remembered that. Yeah. Yes, and it's only half because I was the awkward goth teenager at my high school, which was the age I was when Mean Girls came out, which is why I waited so long to watch it, because I kind of disregarded it at first as a standard teen movie. And then one of my goth friends saw it and was like, no, it's okay, Emily, you can watch this movie. It's actually pretty funny.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I remember actually the same thing. Like I forget who I saw it with the first time, but I remember being kind of hesitant to seeing it and then seeing it and being like, oh my God, you all need to see this. And I ended up seeing that movie like 6 times in theaters. Just, yeah. None of it was wasted money. Also in 2004, we had the movie Garden State. Did you see Garden State? It doesn't matter, but just as a question.
I did not see Garden State.
Okay, that's fine. Well, in that movie, which I will not spoil because, you know, it's really momentous.
I might see it.
It's really momentous and emotional and, oh my God, the Shins will change your life forever. There's a character named, actually, I don't know her name. She's played by Natalie Portman, though. And she is a little archetype that we like to call the Manic Pixie Dream Girl. Anybody that has seen Garden State knows that Natalie Portman's character is super fucking annoying. She's just quirky to be quirky. Like, she wears a motorcycle helmet when she's walking around or something. Is that true? I don't remember. It's been a while since I've seen that movie. She talks to strangers, like, they're her best friend and makes them listen to the Shins, puts headphones on their head. And
this sounds awful, by the way.
Yeah, it really hasn't aged well. I definitely liked it a lot at the time and have, as the years pass, every time I watch it, I keep being like, oh, like I always knew it had problems, but anyways, it's gotten a lot worse. But anyways, important thing, Manic Pixie Dream Girl. This is sort of an archetype that, is older than, the Natalie Portman character in Garden State. I mean, probably the most notable one from before that, that we are aware of is Penny Lane in Almost Famous, the Kate Hudson character, hardcore manic pixie dream girl. And pretty much, well, people generally see Zooey Deschanel, pretty much anything she does is manic pixie dream girl, whether or not that's deserved. And Kirsten Dunst in Elizabethtown. Are there any other ones? Any ones you can think of?
I would say that in Eternal Sunshine.
Oh, yeah, Kate Winslet.
Kate Winslet is a manic pixie dream girl. Although, I mean, that movie's so great that I...
Exactly. And her and Jim Carrey really bugged me in that movie, but I love that movie so much.
But the movie and the story is great. Yeah. As far as a different medium goes, for anyone that might read comics, Ramona in Scott Pilgrim comics is a manic pixie dream girl as well.
She's also in the film, Scott Pilgrim versus the World, for our
That doesn't count.
No? Okay. No. Well, I didn't like the movie either, but I didn't love the comics either. So, yeah, what are your opinions on the Manic Pixie Dream Girl in general?
Well, generally, I don't like it because it's usually an excuse to not fully flesh out a strong female character. Not that she has to be, you know, assertive or something in that way, but just it's kind of an excuse to make an attractive woman who's attractive to kind of more, you know, not like your average Joe, but someone that might think, oh, I only like women that are different and alternative. But yet there's really still, in a lot of cases, not any substance there either. And in some cases that works with the script because it might be clear to the viewer that the relationship happening, like in 500 Days of Summer, maybe shouldn't happen and maybe isn't great. But I guess on a personal level, it bothers me because then I have to hear so many men afterwards just be like, oh, wasn't she so hot in that movie? And like, you know, fantasize about this very kind of a character without any substance and just kind of making substance where there isn't any.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think one of the things that I think is bad about that type of character is, and I see this a lot with discussing 500 Days of Summer, is that people like just sort of ignore what that movie was about, in that it's about not attaching yourself to a quote unquote manic pixie dream girl, because that is the most, that character that Zooey Deschanel plays is the most like a manic pixie dream girl that she has played. And the whole movie is about how Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character kind of made a mistake in sort of like how he was thinking about her. Like, he was just wrong. And I think that most people tend to think of that movie as a sort of love story, I think kind of proves that the Manic Pixie Dream Girl is kind of bad.
Yeah, because you're just like, but she's so cute. Like, yeah. How could they not?
Exactly. It's just like, oh, cute and indie. And she like, I don't know, Ringo Starr solo records, you know, like all this stuff. And I mean, I see people, like I've known people that just remind me of a Manic Pixie Dream Girl, or say things that are like, oh, that's just me, like, about these characters. And it just really bums me out. It's, I don't know, maybe it didn't like years ago, but now I'm just like, oh, that's just a weird thing to associate yourself with. So you're defining yourself with very little. Like, I don't know.
Oh, you know what I just thought of? Did you see Blue Valentine?
Yes, yeah.
Aren't they both kind of like Manic Pixie Dream Girls?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's very true. And I think you could sort of make an argument, like you brought up Kate Winslet in Eternal Sunshine, and there's sort of a type of character that the Manic Pixie Dream Girl sometimes gets attached to, and the quiet, brooding writer type. Yeah. It's not like there aren't male equivalents of these characters.
No, that's
true. It's just, I don't know.
And I don't like the male versions either. I just,
yeah, no, exactly.
Why can't we just write characters that are interesting?
Yeah. And one argument that I've read is that, I forget who wrote this, but it was a blogger or something, wrote that, yeah, this is, it's film. Like, it's, these women can't exist in real life. I recognize that they don't exist in real life. I just want them to exist in film. And that's fine, I guess, but it's also kind of like, I don't know, not the best kind of person still, even in a film, you know. Even for, like, recognizing that they are fictional characters, still, you could get more interesting fictional characters, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's like saying, well, I'd rather have a love story where the male main character is just like a Prince Charming type that doesn't really have any substance, but I just prefer that because I like to see them in movies. Like, I'd rather see all the characters have something to them.
Yep. Yeah, that's fair. Yeah,
you know?
I think actually, just because I like this term, I think that writer contrasted that with sort of like the male version that they called the flighty male with the jaunty hat. And I can't remember any of his examples, but just the term was really funny to me. Any more thoughts on the Manic Pixie Dream Girl that you want to get across?
No, I think everything that I have to say about it is catty and uncalled for. And it really just comes down to the fact that I wish that people could write interesting female characters and not just, you know, build this idea of a woman that they think would be interesting without actually making the audience think about who that person actually is.
Okay, that's fair. I like that. Good little breakdown. Jumping forward a few years, we find ourselves the summer of 2007, Knocked Up gets released. Now you've seen Knocked Up, yes?
Yes, I have many times.
Okay, because it's a great film.
It is great.
Now, there was a bit of a controversy about the film when it came out. It was a bigger hit than anybody really expected. And it, as anything that is a big hit movie that was, you know, sort of a cultural thing for a bit, it got analyzed a lot by writers and by its film stars. Katherine Heigl, who was the lead female in the film, called the movie sexist. Like, came out and called it sexist, I think, while she was promoting it. One, do you think that Knocked Up is a sexist film?
Well, I do, but I think that it is sexist towards both men and women.
Okay.
I think at some point one of the characters tells Seth Rogen's character that, or he says that getting a woman pregnant and being able to have a baby with her, despite the fact that maybe at that point they were having relationship problems and she didn't seem like the best woman. Like, that's as good as you're going to do as a guy, is to have this baby with this woman. And like, really, that's the best that he can do in his whole life.
Yeah.
His destiny is to make a baby with a woman that he had a one night stand with, who's, you know, arguably not a, you know, not the best person for him, maybe, you know?
Yeah, no, that's a valid argument. The reason I've always sort of like, because anytime that sort of sexism argument comes up, people don't present the male side of things generally. But my argument with it is that it's a movie written and directed by a male about a male. You know, like, Katherine Heigl is not the character that this movie is really about. This movie is about Seth Rogen, Ben Stone, and growing up. And, you know, I mean, I think it points to a bigger problem in Hollywood more than anything. But another movie we're going to talk about that's written by a woman focuses entirely on the women. It doesn't make it a sexist movie. It just makes it a movie that's written by a woman, and that's fine. You know, it's just that there aren't a lot of movies written by women, and I think that's sort of the problem.
But. Yeah, definitely, because I don't think we get a lot of Heigl's kind of inner thoughts in that movie. So, I mean, it's hard to kind of, you're not really looking at it from her point of view, the entire situation. So,
yeah, she really is kind of like an exposition slash joke machine. Like, there's really not a lot that is applied to her character. It's just sort of, she's there, you know, to have the baby, which is the driving force of the plot. Yeah. And also, you know, to allow the like Hollywood jokes. She's there to be on the red carpet so that Steve Carell can make a joke, or there to pat down Ryan Seacrest when he's sweating because Jessica Simpson's late for an interview, you know, like, and to vomit. She vomits, and that's comedy.
Yes,
you know?
She does. And it's not that the movie isn't, you know, maybe in some ways sexist towards women. I just wanted to point out that it's kind of a sexist movie as a whole. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that makes it a bad movie. I just think that maybe if you're going to think about it that way, maybe, you know, think about it, but enjoy the movie, because there's problems on both sides. So it's not like,
yeah,
we should boycott it because Katherine Heigl said it was sexist. So
wait, you didn't picket screenings of this movie? I thought as a woman that was part of your duty once Heigl said these things. Now, do you think Apatow movies and, I mean, he's only directed 3 movies, The 40-Year-Old Virgin being another one and Funny People being the other. Mm-hmm. But he's also produced 1,000 others like Anchorman, Talladega Nights. I can't believe I'm blanking on these, but you know those Apatow, Superbad, Pineapple Express. Do you think Apatow movies and movies that have that name over their title are generally sexist? Do you think that's sort of a theme, whether it's intentional or not? I assume it's not, but
I can't see it being intentional. Generally, all of those movies are comedies and the main characters are young men.
Yeah, no, exactly.
So there's going to be certain jokes and there's going to be certain themes. And sometimes, you know, watching an Apatow movie, I might go, you know, did you really have to do that? Yeah. But I think it's just kind of the nature of making a movie and, you know, as a man and then having the main characters be male and seeing everything from a male point of view, that's, you might see some problems with that. But I think you'd see it the other way as well. Movies, you know, with women main characters, it's not like they never make jokes about men.
Yeah.
So it, maybe just because people generally think, oh, Apatow movies are good movies, so maybe they get a little bit more criticism.
Yeah. No, I think that's fair, because Apatow generally is respected. Mm-hmm. I think validly. Like, I don't love every movie he's produced. I don't even love every movie he's directed, but he's got a good batting average, I think. And I mean, and also in comedies, like, what's the genre more likely to offend other than maybe horror, you know, like if things are getting to the Saw territory, but even then it's just like, let's see how we can gross you out. It's not like, you know, words accidentally or saying a gay joke that people maybe don't approve of or something like that.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, he puts his hilarious wife and kids in his movies, right? And they usually kind of make it in a way.
Yeah. Well, Leslie Mann's hilarious. you didn't see Funny People, right?
I did see Funny People.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought the part where he literally makes us watch his kids like ballet recital, that was a big problem for me. That was a little too much chutzpah there, Jed. Also in 2007, a movie that probably nobody listening to this podcast saw was released. It was called The Brave One, starring Jodie Foster. It was kind of like, it was a vengeance thriller, directed by Neil Jordan, also co-starring Terrence Howard in his hat. And it was Jodie Foster's husband or partner gets murdered at the beginning of the film, and the rest of the film is about her tracking those guys down. It's a Taxi Driver kind of thing, except Jodie Foster isn't insane. Well, I mean, depending on your opinions on vigilantes. Anyways, it was kind of a decent movie. Nobody saw it. And after it failed at the box office, Warner Brothers president of production, Jeff Robinov, allegedly sent out a memo or said something along the lines of, "We are no longer doing movies with women in the lead." This being a blanket statement, and apparently he also wouldn't even look at scripts with women protagonists. He thought, and these are sort of like insider speculation and reports, basically what Nikki Fink wrote about it the week after, saying that he thought no woman other than Julia Roberts could carry a movie. And he blamed, you know, his idea was because of the failure of also, besides The Brave One, Nancy Drew, The Reaping, which was a terrible looking horror movie with Hilary Swank, and The Invasion, which was the Invasion of the Body Snatchers remake with, Nicole Kidman. All of those movies failed. And yeah, so then he was just like, no more movies with women. This was in 2007. That's insane, right?
It is insane. It sounds to me like something someone would say who's, you know, got a very business mind when it comes to making movies and doesn't really think about anything other than, I guess this doesn't work. But obviously coming from a very just crazy point of view.
Yeah. No, I know. It's just like, I remember at the time being like, what? Really? And even when I was like thinking about what we were going to talk about on this podcast, I was like, oh yeah, that crazy thing. Did that happen? And then I looked it up and happened. And I don't know. There are reasons for all those movies failing too. And I think you can sort of say that for any movie that really fails. Like The Invasion, Nicole Kidman doesn't draw people to the box office. Nancy Drew was apparently terrible. Same with The Reaping. And The Brave One, it was sort of, Jodie Foster generally draws in, you know, middle-aged women and who have been following her career, and maybe they don't want to see a revenge thriller. You know, like, that was sort of the reasoning for that. And I don't know. I like Jodie Foster. I thought that was a decent movie, and just the whole thing kind of bummed me out. I'm sure Warner Brothers has since made a movie starring women. But, you know, just to have that happen kind of the worst.
I think what maybe makes that even worse than the fact that he said that is just that, I mean, obviously movies starring men fail, but that's not what is the unique thing about those movies to someone in the industry. That's not what makes that movie unique.
Well, yeah, obviously, because the man can never be blamed for the failure of a film. It's always the woman's fault.
It's like, we're not going to make comic movies anymore or something, right? We're not going to make lady movies anymore. Like, it's just very, we're not going to make crappy movies anymore. Like, that's what he should have
How dare said. You? Everybody knows the Green Lantern failed because Blake Lively is terrible. Everybody knows that. The Gossip Girl fans can't support a big blockbuster? Who knew? Jodie Foster, the actress, the lead actress in The Brave One, I find her interesting because she seems to have somehow avoided being typecast. Like, she plays a wide variety of different characters, but she's always sort of playing strong women. Like, people don't get the best of her very often. And even going back as far as Taxi Driver, she's kind of a unique character in that movie. I recognize she's a prostitute. But, you know, James and I talked about it on our podcast, but she's still a decent character in that movie. Are there any women you think get typecast, like, to a fault? I generally, typecasting is a problem for male actors as well, you know, but do you think it's a bigger problem for females?
I can't think of anyone immediately that I think, oh, this person is always typecast and that is a problem. I think maybe if there's more of a problem there, it's that there are less kind of opportunities for women. So they have to fit into one of three or four kinds of roles. Mm-hmm. Whereas maybe for men, there's a little bit more of a, is there even, I don't know if there's a little bit more room there. to kind of grow as an actor?
Well, I feel like there are more character actors that are male, if only because more small parts will be given to older males. Like, you don't see a lot of, you know, 40 to 50 plus female characters, even in small parts. And if they're small parts, they're, you know, just there for 30 seconds to be a gas station attendant, you know? And yeah, I do think there are more males get typecast as well. But there are just more opportunities for you to get typecast, yeah, and more lanes, you know? Like there's the gay best friend, there's the best friend, there's the, old wise man, the Liam Neeson, if you will. And oh God, why am I blanking? There are a lot of opportunities. Whereas I think females tend to get typecast in either sort of like the, maybe not damsel in distress, but the more damsel type. And then, you know, the best friend, again, you know, like Chris Messina is somebody nobody knows because he plays the best friend in so many romantic comedies. He's a guy. And he's the best friend of Jason Sudeikis and whatever comedy he is the lead in or something. Yeah. Those exist for women as well. And then there's the badass chick as well. You know, the, and this is the one I think nobody's more typecast than Michelle Rodriguez, I think. She started out in that movie, Girl Fight, which you've seen, yes?
Yes, I have. Yeah. In film class with you, right?
Yeah. Just making sure you didn't skip that day or something. Yeah. which is a great movie. I really enjoy it. But Michelle Rodriguez, I've always sort of thought was like typecast as just sort of the badass. And it's just like, oh, well, she'll just never have a chance to do anything else. But here's an interesting quote from her. Oh, baby. And this is at Comic-Con in this last year. Oh, baby, I was typecast the minute I did a film called Girl Fight years ago. That has nothing to do with anything. It's just to do with you allow yourself to be typecast. If I decided I didn't want to be typecast tomorrow, I'd just go do an indie film where I play some poor girl who goes through some excruciating experience and win myself an award for crying or being raped or playing someone with mental illness. But at the end of the day, I'm not in it for the acting. If I were in it for the acting, then I would be worried about people not giving me the opportunity to express my vast array of emotions on the screen. I could give two shits. I only want to be someone I respect or someone that I consider interesting or fun. I'm here to entertain people and make a statement about female empowerment and strength. And that's what I've done for the last 10 years. And people can call it typecast, but I pigeonholed myself and I put myself in that box, saying no to everything else that came on my plate, saying no to the girlfriend, saying no to the girl that gets captured, no to this, no to that. And eventually I just got left with the strong chick that's always being killed. And there's nothing wrong with that.
That's an incredible quote.
I think it's pretty great. Like, it's, I don't know. She is probably one of the people I would have put on a top 10 people you would least expect to be interesting. And then I read this, like, I think yesterday, and I was just, like, suddenly interesting. You know, like, I think that's an interesting quote for sure.
Because I would think if there's any upside to being typecast is you always have work, right? And if you want to be a working actor and make money acting, being typecast is great because you do have maybe less opportunities in a way, but you always have those opportunities to play that character, which I guess is basically what she's saying. And yeah, that's great. That would be my argument. So apparently we could be friends.
Yeah. You and Michelle Rodriguez should hang out. M-Rod, give Emily a call if you're listening. Also, please make Fast 6. That movie looks like it's going to be the best. Well, I guess I have a question for you then. If you were an actress, let's say you are.
Okay.
Let's say you're an actress in Hollywood,
yes,
who is going to be typecast. You know that you will be typecast into something. Which would you choose? Would it be sort of maybe the best friend? Would you like to be the tough woman? Would you like to be the damsel in distress type? Or the Manic Pixie Dream Girl, perhaps. What would your choice be if you had to be typecast as something?
I get to choose? Yeah. Or am I being realistic?
It's like you've seen the future. You know you're going to... It's like choose your own adventure. Choose your own typecasting. You've got four avenues that you can choose, or, you know, however many ideas you can think of. What would you select? What type of role would you want to play for 12 years?
I would want to, well, I don't know. I think I would like to be somebody funny, like one of those kind of, that girl that gets to be in the Apatow movies because she's funny, you know, mm-hmm, those girls. I don't think if this actually happened, I wouldn't be able to be that character. I would have to be, you know, like, I don't even know. like Penelope Cruz.
Okay. Well, I mean, this is ideally. Like, you can pull off whatever you want to be.
Yeah. Maybe if I could be as funny as Kristen Wiig, I would like to come in for those cameos where she like totally steals Knocked Up. Like that's the funny thing I remember from Knocked Up is her.
Yep.
That would be yes, please. That's the one.
Okay. Casting directors, just so you know. And, I guess I think I asked you this. Are there any actresses you think are getting typecast now? I did ask this, right?
Maybe. Yeah. I guess I just don't think about it cause I don't really have too much of a problem with it. Like I can't think of anywhere that I'm like, it's such a shame that this actor is typecast because they could do so much more. Like I don't know.
Yeah. I think generally people don't think that until,
they get to do more than
that. Yeah. Until, I mean, maybe this isn't a great example, but until Bill Murray does Lost in Translation, you know, I mean, he's still playing very much Bill Murray, but there was a dramatic role that people liked. And it's not like that was the first dramatic role he did. But anyway, moving on. Another film that came out in 2007, which sort of disproved Mr. Romanov's thinking by making a bunch of money, was Juno. What did you think about Juno, generally? You've seen Juno, right?
Yes, I saw it. And I generally, I like Juno because I love Ellen Page.
Okay.
I love her so much. Ellen Page, I love you.
You know, I watched it the other night. She's got a real Michelle Williams walk to her. She's really awkward, and it's kind of awesome.
Amazing.
Yeah, all through like the first half of that movie, before she's like really pregnant, she's just swinging her arms when she walks. Anyways, it's very Michelle Williams in the Dawson's Creek pilot-esque.
That's a great joke that maybe someone will get.
Yeah, you know. That's all we're hoping to reach. So you like, were the things you didn't like about it?
The stupid fake catchphrases like honest to blog.
Yeah.
Were a little bit, they're just over the top. Mm. I think you can be a little bit more mean girls in the way your teens talk, where it sounds a little bit more realistic than this is this like hyper fantasy world where people say honest to blog, which mm-hmm. they don't. I don't know. I think that it was a little bit maybe candy coated looking back. Like obviously at the end, you know, she has the baby, she gives it up. And I cried in the theater. I was like, oh my God.
Oh my God, babies.
She gave birth and gave her baby away. You know, like that was sad. But then they just are a teen couple after that. I just found that a little, like that's a lot for somebody to go through.
Yeah, there are a lot of things about Juno that just don't work. I don't like the way it sort of like skirts around abortion. It's like fingernails. Okay, we're moving on. Like when Su Chen's like baby has fingernails. And I think with the catchphrase thing, I think, the weird thing about that movie is that all of those types of reference, and not all of them, but it's really, really front heavy. Like there's the one scene right after the credits where she's in the convenience store with, Rainn Wilson, and they just drop like an insane, like what's the verdict, Fertile Myrtle or something like that. Oh, yeah. And then when she calls her best friend, that's when you get the honest to blog line and a variety of other things. Other than after that, it's pretty spread out and it's really not that bad. It's just that I think front loading so much was a bad idea, or maybe a good idea because that movie really caught on. But the other thing I think that allows it to be tied up so nicely is that it's really just a teen movie. It's just, it happens to be a teen movie that really caught on. And I think that's sort of why people judge it in a different way. But I think it's a good movie. It has its problems. But yeah, I think that it all wraps up so nicely is like, oh, okay, fine. You're really just a teen movie at heart.
Yeah, we can sing this adorable song together at the end because, you know, this is how we grow as human beings. We gave away this baby and now we can be indie together.
Yeah, and as neatly as that bow is tied, let's not act like that isn't an adorable scene. Come on.
Oh, absolutely. And it's Jennifer Garner, right? That's the mom. That entire plot line, I think, is really great. Like her being a new mom and getting the baby. And I thought she was very interesting because she did decide to keep the baby, even though she and what's his face?
Jason Bateman.
Yeah. They broke up, right?
Yeah.
So I thought that was pretty...
They break up because he's the worst.
Yes.
Yeah. That's the big one of the biggest problems about their thing is
he like is hitting on Ellen Page and stuff, right?
He's never really hitting on her, but it's very weird.
It's creepy.
Like they have a relationship that I would classify as uncouth.
Yeah.
They slow dance in a basement at one point while she's very pregnant.
Do.
And that's when he tells her that he's going to leave.
Ooh. Yeah.
I don't think it's ever really implied that he's leaving her because he's met Juno, you know? Like that's not it. But yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyways, generally positive.
Yeah.
Juno.
Yeah, and I agree about the Jennifer Garner character. I thought she was interesting. I really liked Allison Janney's character as well, Juno's stepmom. Because when Juno's telling her parents that she's pregnant, Juno's dad is all, you know, I'm going to punch that bleaker kid in the wiener when I see him, that type of stuff. Whereas instantly, the mom character is just like, okay, we need to do this, this, this. And she's very mom, you know, like, it's just like, yeah. And then after she leaves the room, she says to the dad, you know, yeah, this is the worst, but whatever, we have to support her. And I thought that was just so mom-like, you know, and I enjoyed that, but, or at least good mom.
Yeah. Very supportive no matter what, mm-hmm. you know, don't have to go through it alone.
Yeah. The big thing about Juno was, which you've pointed out, is the writing, or that's why I think anybody would agree that it really caught on. Have you seen any of Diablo Cody's other movies, being Jennifer's Body or Young Adult?
No, I haven't. Have you seen Young Adult? Was it?
Yes, I loved Young Adult.
Yeah?
Oh, it was really weird, and like I wasn't sure I liked it initially, mm-hmm. but once I thought about it, I was like, that was a really ballsy movie, and there's plenty in it that I don't like, but it was funny and I thought it was extremely interesting and very, I don't know, it was very pointed with its opinions, which I liked because they were opinions I agreed with. But
I do know the plot generally and it sounds interesting, but
I would recommend it, but there are going to be things where you're like, oh, that's not okay. Like this,
right.
This is a bad scene. This is a bad thing to put in your movie.
Yeah.
But generally awesome. and you didn't see Jennifer's Body either?
No, I didn't see Jennifer's Body.
Yeah. Okay. Well then, no more questions about Diablo Cody. Jennifer's Body was basically a really bad Buffy the Vampire Slayer episode.
Okay.
It had its moments where it was good and then most of it wasn't very good. But, you know, I wasn't upset that I sat through it. And just out of curiosity, can you name any female directors off the top of your head?
The one that did the Bomb movie.
Her name is Kathryn Bigelow. Okay. And the Bomb movie was The Hurt Locker.
Yeah, that's about it. What about Diablo Cody's Oscar speech and all that?
Yeah, I don't remember her Oscar speech. Do you?
I don't remember it exactly, but I remember her going up on stage and she's wearing like a leopard print dress. Tattoos are on display. I liked how she, I mean, obviously after a while it became like we get it. You used to be a stripper, work at a strip club or burlesque or I'm not sure exactly what it was, but I liked that she didn't just turn into Hollywood right away. She was just like, yeah, I'm going to come up and get my Oscar wearing this like leopard print dress. And this is what I think of your award show, you know, like, thanks for this. And I don't know. I remember watching it and being like, yes, good. I'm glad you were just like, thank you so much for this award.
Yeah. Okay. That's a Melissa Leo, perhaps. It was just in tears and dropping F-bombs and just giving the worst acceptance speech of all time. I can only even think of three directors off the top of my head, and one of them doesn't have a great career. Moving on to this year, there was a little film that came out in May. It's called Bridesmaids. It was starring Kristen Wiig. In a lead role, not playing the type of role that you have decided you want to play for 12 years, should you become an actress. What did you think of Bridesmaids?
I liked Bridesmaids. I thought it was funny. I thought it was a good movie. I enjoyed watching it. It was a lot sadder than I think a lot of people were expecting. There was a lot of kind of serious aspects of Kristen Wiig's life that I think, you know, the trailer definitely did not, did not show. Although it is not the sort of movie that I would want to watch over and over again.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. I saw it a couple times. That's good enough for me. And I thought it was funny. I didn't love it. Like the thing that was the most interesting about Bridesmaids, well, it made a lot of money And people were apparently surprised about that, even though every movie produced by Judd Apatow makes a lot of money. Yeah, and it was sort of treated as, like, this rallying call for women in comedy. Like, suddenly women in comedy are a thing again. Or, for the first time ever, I don't know. And it's just... Maybe it was just because I was freshly unemployed and was very dedicated to my Twitter feed that month. But, like, was it really that big of a deal that a movie starring women, like, I guess five women was a hit? Or is it more just, I don't know. I don't even know. It was very confusing.
It did get a lot more kind of buzz than you might expect a movie of that quality to get, just because it starred women.
Yeah.
But no, I don't know if it was groundbreaking. I mean, I think it's good just showing that those, like, movies starring a lot of women about a female topic, getting married, can be successful, because that's probably good and will, you know, allow us to make more movies starring lots of women. But no, it really got kind of a huge... This is the turning point for women in movies.
Yeah, I don't know. And it's like... Yeah, I guess it must be a movie-specific thing, because my argument was always, yeah, there are a lot of really funny women doing just fine right now, namely Kristen Wiig on SNL, you know, like, people, like, she was, I don't know, people that knew she was funny already, and we've talked about Tina Fey, Amy Poehler is amazing on Parks and Rec, and a variety of other female comedians are in those two shows, but yeah, I guess it was just sort of a movie thing, and movie-specific thing, and I think... Also, The Bad Teacher was like an R-rated raunchy comedy, even though nobody saw it. It was sort of like part of the movement, just because it came out a month after Bridesmaids. And I don't know. It was just very confusing to me, because I guess I didn't think it was that revolutionary. And I don't think it's going to show to be like this big, important... I don't think Bridesmaids is going to be a Hollywood milestone 10 years from now, you know?
No, I don't think so. Because the plot is very kind of meandering. It's not like one of those movies that's like a classic that you want to put in over and over again. So I don't see how it can be a milestone, because no one's going to really remember. They'll be like, oh yeah, that movie, Bridesmaids, that was funny.
Yeah. And it's like, I mean, Wedding Crashers was a huge hit and a very funny movie in 2004. Nobody watches Wedding Crashers today, you know? Like,
no. No, I think maybe just because everyone saw Bridesmaids, and maybe it was just because those people, the kind of people that think they don't like movies about women, were like, I enjoyed this film. And so that made it really, you know, transformative.
Yeah. And I guess, like, maybe what I was thinking was that, because I guess I thought a lot about the Legally Blonde and, because Legally Blonde was kind of like Bridesmaids in that it was a hit movie that nobody expected to be a hit movie. I think Bridesmaids' opening weekend was like $35 million, and then it kept making money. In 2001 terms, that's not that far off from like the $20 million that Legally Blonde made. And then I just sort of felt like, well, it's probably just a cyclical thing. Like, if Bridesmaids has a sequel, which it probably won't, maybe it fails. I don't think it would, but maybe it does. And then people are just sort of like, oh, women aren't funny again. You know, Jerry Lewis was right, or whatever he said. Do you know this quote? Jerry Lee Lewis. Was it Jerry Lee Lewis or Jerry Lewis? I don't know. Which one's the comedian?
Jerry Lewis, I think.
Yeah.
He said women aren't funny.
Yeah, just blanket statement.
Well, what else can you say to get your writing read by everyone? Yeah. Like, I think that was just kind of like an inflammatory...
Yeah, Christopher Hitchens said that too, right?
Yeah. Oh, okay. If you want everyone to know who you are, say that, I guess.
Yeah. All I know about Christopher Hitchens is that he said that and he also died. Those are the things I know about Christopher Hitchens. Also atheism, probably. Yeah, and I just sort of feel like it's probably just a cyclical thing. Like, this will happen again in 5 years and I will be perplexed by my Twitter feed or whatever news gathering source I'm using then again, you know? Yeah, Bridesmaids, not that revolutionary, but funny. Which is cool.
Yes, yeah. Very funny, and probably is going to allow Melissa McCarthy to make some more money, which is good.
She signed, like, so many more deals than I would think one person can handle. She's going to be like Robert Downey Jr. in 2007 soon, just being everywhere. Just because she signed, like, two movie deals and a TV show deal to go with Mike and Molly, like, that already exists. Yeah. So, I don't know. Very confusing. Yeah, I... I guess we should wrap this up by talking about television characters, because we haven't done a lot of that other than Liz Lemon.
And you know I love TV.
Yes, you watch more TV than movies.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, because you can't do things while you're at the movie theater. You can make pierogies while you're watching 30 Rock.
It's true, again, for the 30th time.
Yeah. So are there any female characters on television? Like, because I think, and I'm sure you would agree, it's just easier to have a good female character on television just because the stakes are lower because there's less money involved generally. Also, you have more time to flesh out secondary characters. So, say like the pilot of Friday Night Lights, Coach's wife really says nothing, does nothing. She has like three lines. And then by the end of the show, she's just one of my favorite characters on television ever. And I think it's sort of that and also the lower stakes. Like, are there any female characters that you really enjoy on television?
So many of them. And I think that that's not something I've ever really considered. The difference between, if you asked me, oh, what are your favorite women in movies? I'd be like, But as far as, you know, women in television shows, almost every show I watch has an interesting female character. We've already talked about Parks and Rec and 30 Rock, but even the secondary characters in Parks and Rec are amazing. Like, even, you know, even Rashida Jones's character, even though she gets kind of less and less.
Yeah, she gets so little to work with, but
she always nails it.
Yeah, no, she's amazing. You're preaching to a large choir for Rashida Jones, you know, but
even, you know, the one female character on The League is great.
Yeah,
you know, and that's such like a male point of view kind of a show.
Yeah.
Animated shows, Kristen Schaal and Bob's Burgers might be one of my favorite characters on television of all time.
I think we can count Kristen Schaal on The Daily Show is just because she's so amazing on The Daily Show.
We'll just count Kristen Schaal.
Yeah, Kristen Schaal.
All of the times she
All of the times.
Acts.
Yeah.
When you mentioned Friday Night Lights, Coach's wife, she...
We'll stop calling her Coach's wife. We'll stop identifying as
the wife. No, but everybody calls her Coach's wife.
Exactly. She's Mrs. Coach or Coach's wife.
What's
Tammy
her name?
Taylor.
Oh, yeah, Tammy. Well, because her name's Tammy. I don't know.
But she's the most charming woman in the world.
She is, and she gets so many of those kind of... I haven't seen all of Friday Night Lights, so I just started season 4. But she gets so many of those times where she gets to be kind of... maybe more of what you would think of like the stereotypical wife would do, like wanting to buy a house they can't afford and them having to talk about, you know, we can't afford that. And she's like, oh, but it's so nice, you know, and then going all the way from being, you know, in charge as the principal, you know, she kind of gets to be a real person from, you know, the things that people do that are stereotypical for whoever they happen to be to, you know, the things that make us most interesting. And I think that that's really cool that she gets to run that whole kind of a whole spectrum.
Yeah. One character that I know you enjoy quite a bit, or perhaps don't, who you have spent a lot of your time with, is Buffy Summers from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. What are your opinions on Buffy?
Well, I will try to fit this into a reasonable amount of time.
Yeah. Not all of your opinions, but yeah.
Some of them. Yeah. Buffy, I mean, how many Buffy spoilers can I do? Can we say that everyone should have seen it already?
Yeah, this is a show that ended like 8 years ago, 9 years ago. You can spoil whatever you want.
Okay.
And I won't be offended even though we're currently going through the show.
We are. We're on season 3. That's great. Buffy runs from, I am a strong female character because I do fighting with vampires to in maybe the later seasons being, oh, I don't want to spoil this for you. If anyone out there has watched Buffy, then you'll know. He's going to edit it, so I can't really say anything.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
But, you know, despite kind of her really annoying relationship with Angel in the first couple seasons, where she can seem, you know, kind of helpless, then, you know, she kills him. So that's kind of a huge thing. Like, oh, I'm 16 and I'm going to kill the guy that took my virginity and turned evil and killed people that I knew. Like, that's kind of huge. There's just so much, like... to talk about as far as like women goes in Buffy, because it's primarily it's a women based focused show.
Yeah.
So it's amazing in all ways.
All right. Willow, another character on the show who I feel like perhaps you like more, or less, or I don't know.
No, I do. I do love Willow. Fun fact, Joss set up Buffy in the first few seasons so that either Xander or Willow could have been gay. So they were just, he was just kind of playing it out. I don't know, to see what worked better. So there's like some episodes where Xander, I think the swim team episode with Xander, there's somebody suggests that he might be gay and that it's okay. And he's like, no. And that was one of the setups, I think, for Xander being gay. But anyways, Willow being a lesbian character on television in, you know, the early 2000s.
Yeah.
That was pretty great. You know, she has a very mature relationship with another woman, and it's not a focus of the show. That's not what the show's about. She's just, you know, it's okay it's just kind of, you know, that's someone's friend and they accept that. Although we did watch Dawson's Creek and they have a really great
gay
character story as well. So I can't say that Buffy was the first to do it, but
I think there were more gay male characters before there were gay female characters. And I think that's why Willow is interesting as a lesbian character. And I mean, we haven't gotten to that point in the show.
No, we're not there yet. She's still dating Oz wants to date Oz.
Yeah. But yeah, and I think, I mean, by this time, by like late 90s, you've got Will and Grace, all the gay characters in that show.
What about the Ellen show?
Ellen, yeah, that's true. Ellen was like the very special episode. I forget what it was called.
In the closet.
Yeah, something about a dog was in Mr. Show ripping on it. Anyways. but yeah, the Ellen very special episode was important. But yeah, I think that show ended like a year after that, though. It really didn't last long.
Yeah, and I mean, to have kind of like a young woman in college having a relationship with another woman that's in no way about what men think about it. Yeah. You know, it's not about just like, oh, I made out with my friend. Whoops. You know, like it's a real relationship between two people. And that was really cool. And actually when I started watching Buffy again, I was like, oh yeah, that happens. Like I almost couldn't believe it, even though I started watching it maybe in 2007 or something like that.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, this is also a show that exists on a television channel that was easy to get, you know, like any of the bisexuality or something present in 6 Feet Under was, you know, like no kid is watching that, like no average is watching that because they don't have HBO
but everyone was watching Buffy. That was kind of
exactly
a big thing.
And another character, I love her, I think you love her, on the show How I Met Your Mother is Robin Scherbatsky.
Love Scherbatsky.
Yeah. The best.
Who doesn't love Scherbatsky?
I don't know, but I'm willing to fight him.
Not only because she's Canadian.
Yeah, that's true. And they make good use of her Canadian.
They really do. It's not just like a throwaway. Sometimes there are sustained jokes about it that are just great.
Her playing, like, her getting too drunk and talking about Game 7 of the Canucks-Rangers final. Oh my God. It's so funny. The Rangers are going to be sorry they ever played Shunny with the Canucks. Like, it's so good. But yeah, what do you think about Robin generally, even when she's not drunk and talking about hockey?
Robin is great because even though How I Met Your Mother, I would say, I mean, I love all of the characters on How I Met Your Mother, but it's been quite a while and they haven't gone too far from where they started in the season one or season two.
Yep.
You know, especially like, you know, Barney. I think only in the last couple seasons have they been like, oh, these characters have to develop somehow.
Yeah, Barney in the fifth season, and the fifth season was really bad because of that. I always hated that Barney had to develop, but anyways.
Yeah, I mean, liked eventually. It
better. He was never really a person, you know? No. Why do you have to make him a person?
That's true. So despite all of that, she's always managed to be the most interesting character, you know, trying to balance a career and the things that she might want relationship-wise in a fairly realistic way, as far as How I Met Your Mother is realistic, being like a very obvious set-based show where they sit in the same spot every single episode. Recently, it has become very interesting. Can we spoil How I Met Your Mother?
This is going to be the last thing we talk about on the podcast. So if you don't watch How I Met Your Mother, you might as well stop listening. Thanks for listening.
Now
we're going to spoil How I Met Your Mother.
So the recent episode where Robin thinks she's pregnant, and I have to admit, I was like, is she going to have Barney's baby? Like, what is happening?
Yeah,
here?
They're in Barney's apartment. The stormtrooper's there. Like, the beginning of the episode starts, and this is the Christmas episode. It's the 12th episode of the 7th season. And the episode begins with now kids, and it's the standard narration, but this time it's not Ted narrating the show. It's Robin, which might be the first time somebody other than Ted has narrated the show for an extended period of time. I didn't watch season 5 or 6 a lot. I didn't really care for those seasons, but... can you remember anything? Like, I know they've used it as a joke before, but...
There's a recent... I think the most recent episode, Barney does some of the narration, but it's not to the same kind of serious extent as Robin doing it.
Yeah. And yeah, she's just telling kids, her kids, about, you know, it's How I Met Your Father, right? Mm-hmm. Or the story of them. And she's, in the episode, she gets pregnant, and, or finds out she's pregnant. Yeah, and... How does it develop? How does the episode develop?
Well, that story arc, I can't remember. I don't think it's all... Well, no, it is all just mostly in that one episode. She finds out she's not pregnant and then finds out that she cannot have children. And I will admit that I cried. Although I cry a lot when I watch TV and movies, as Alex can... Alex knows from when we had film class together. He would look over to me after like every movie and I'd be like, it's okay. I'm fine.
Deep Impact is really emotional, guys. When Taya Leone looks back at the tidal wave.
But yeah, that was very emotionally done because as a viewer, I was like, oh my gosh, like this is Robin telling her story about her children. And then it ends with her kind of saying, you know, that it was just kind of, you know, they didn't actually exist and that she can't have children. And I was just like, what just happened here? That was a very emotional episode and made her a much more interesting character. Whether or not they'll ever kind of go back to that, it's hard to say.
I feel like they will because there's been a lot of developing of Robin this season. And like really this season has been just as much about her as it has been Ted, I think. And I enjoy
who cares about Ted anymore?
Well, nobody's ever cared about Ted. He's just sort of been there to drive the story. But that's kind of what's amazing about How I Met Your Mother is the best parts of How I Met Your Mother, I find, are when they pull the rug out from under you. And I think that was one of the best moments that they did that. And it was also a really emotional thing. And Robin, who apparently never wants kids, like that's always been her thing in the show. And she just takes it really hard. And I just thought it was great. And Robin Scherbatsky in general is an interesting character because she's not the stereotypical feminine television character either. Like she's a very feminine character, but she's also got a lot of traits that would be described as masculine. Like for a lot of the first seasons, she's referred to as the lady bro, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, her dad kind of raised her as wanting her to be a boy, which is why she knows how to play hockey and knows things about sports and probably where her masculine characteristics come from. And it doesn't really seem to be a bad thing. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not like her dad ruined her somehow by doing this. She obviously has issues with her dad, but it's not, you know, a negative thing that she acts that way. So,
yeah. I just love Scherbatsky. So thank you for joining us on the MacGuffin Men.
Thanks, Alex.
Thank you for your opinions on women. And hopefully we'll have you back at some point.
I would love to be back.
Yeah. So yeah, thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. Send us an email at themacguffinmen@gmail.com. So thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. This episode has been brought to you by Joss Whedon. Love it. Lest you be the outcast in your community of outcasts. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.